Hi friends, this is Brock Polk, and I want to thank you for downloading this sermon from Heritage Church of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. Our mission is to lead others to a thriving relationship with Jesus, and if you're ready to take a next step in your faith journey after you listen to this message, you can contact us through our website at www.heritagechurchofchrist.org. God bless you, and I hope you enjoy the following message.
It was another interesting week in the news this week. Lots of big stuff going on. And it seems like those weeks are happening like with consistency now. You know, there's just never a quiet week when nothing's really going on. But the two big stories that were on everybody's mind and attention this week were a little bit different than maybe the norm, not some of the political stuff that's been going on. One of them was Hurricane Michael, this hurricane, the fourth largest hurricane to ever strike the United States, and drove all kinds of devastation, you know, and flooding and rain and damage and all of that kind of stuff through the Florida Panhandle and other areas that eventually were affected, led to at least 18 deaths so far, and lots of people who are going to be feeling like they are in one of the darkest moments of their life, one of the most hopeless moments of their life. And we have lots of reason to be praying for people that are affected by that. At the same time, there was this parallel story, this concurrent story that was going on about in the financial markets, about a huge sell-off in the stock market, and it triggered all sorts of panic and prediction about a bear market that might be on the horizon, and there were hundreds of billions of dollars worth of valuation that were disappearing over just a couple of days. And the first one of these stories was about this overwhelming suffering that's really going to be difficult for a lot of people to be able to bounce back from, and the second story was about wondering when the free fall is ever going to stop. You know, like, is there ever going to be a bottom to the dip? What's it going to do? Is it going to level out, and are things going to get any better? And both of those stories, the themes of those stories are reminiscent of the themes we've been discovering together the last couple of weeks in our message series called Not According to Plan. We've been taking a look together for the last three weekends, working through the final chapters of the book of Genesis, the very first book in your Bible, and we've been looking at some of the significant segments in the life of a character named Joseph. And as we've investigated his life, we've discovered that his story is one of the most troubled and tragic stories that most of us have ever read. And in case you weren't here, I'll fill you in or remind you a little bit. Joseph, as a young adult, his life was full of suffering that he didn't expect and suffering that he didn't deserve. He was attacked by his 10 older brothers who were jealous of the way that he was treated within their family. He was attacked by these brothers, and they saw an opportunity to sell him and to make money selling him as a slave. So they sold him to some slave traders who ended up carting him away to Egypt and sold him as a slave to an Egyptian political official there. And that man's wife eventually falsely accused Joseph of assault, at which point he was unfairly thrown into prison. He was held captive there for years. And he was just sitting there, just waiting for somebody on the outside to realize that he had been jailed unreasonably. And if you just take a look at just one of the moments, if you just listen to one of the chapters, maybe one of the sections that we have studied together over the last three weekends, you could see how his suffering and his future looked devastating in all of these episodes. I mean, bouncing back from the betrayal, bouncing back from the trafficking, bouncing back from the enslavement felt nearly impossible. And it reminds me of the way that many people must be feeling in Florida and those areas now, just feeling like, how are we ever going to bounce back from what we've just experienced? But like the other news story, Joseph's story just kept getting worse. It was in free fall. And surely he was wondering, when is my life going to finally level out? When are things going to turn a different direction? When are my circumstances going to change? And today is the moment that we've been building toward throughout our series. We're going to hear the culmination of Joseph's saga, and for the first time, we're going to get to hear Joseph's interpretation of what's been happening to him over the course of his adult life. So if you've got a Bible with you this morning, I'd be thrilled for you to join me. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 41. Again, Genesis is the very first book in your Bible, so if you've got a table of contents, it's easy to find that way. If you've got the Heritage app on your smartphone, you ought to be able to click there where it says this Sunday, and it'll take you to a button where you can find this real easy, Genesis 41. But At the end of last week's passage in chapter 40, you may remember Joseph was still stuck as a prisoner. He had made friends with a guy who was released from prison, and on his way out the door, Joseph had said, "Dude, you're going to run into some people who have the power to get me out of here. Will you remember me and tell them my story? Because I don't deserve to be here." And the guy was like, "Yeah, no problem." And then he walked out the door and totally forgot everything about Joseph. And chapter 41, verse 1 says that one night, 2 years later, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, had these two dreams, and he was desperate. He had this gut feeling that the dreams must carry some significance. They were that weighty. And he had this desperation. He wanted to know what the dreams were all about. So he calls in all of his advisors, calls in all of the people that he trusts to give him good counsel. And he tells them about the dream and says, "What do you think these mean?" And they all say, "We don't have any idea." And then Pharaoh's cupbearer, who happens to be the same guy I just mentioned that Joseph befriended in the prison, Joseph's cupbearer, I think he's just standing in the room doing his job, and he overhears what's going on, and suddenly he's like, "Oh man, I was supposed to talk about this." And he tells Pharaoh, this is in verse number 9, chapter 41, verse 9, it says, "Finally the chief cupbearer," the king's chief cupbearer, "spoke up, and he said, 'Today, listening to your conversation here, I've been reminded of my failure. I've been reminded that I was supposed to tell you something,' he told Pharaoh. He says, 'Some time ago, you were angry with the chief baker and me, and you imprisoned us in the palace of the captain of the guard.'" Now, I've got to assume the cupbearer is not eager to bring this story back up to Pharaoh's attention, right? He's not wanting to remind him of why he got angry with him in the first place. He's like, "So this is totally water under the bridge. Don't even worry about that. No problem. Forget that I mentioned it. Except when I was in prison one night, the chief baker and I," verse 11, "we each had a dream, and each dream had its own meaning. And there was this young Hebrew guy that was there with us in the prison. He was a slave of the captain of the guard. And we told the Hebrew guy about our dreams, and he told us what our dreams meant. And then everything he predicted, everything he interpreted, actually happened." And don't ever bring this up again. You know, like, he's like, "Let's not talk about that." But the cupbearer finally remembered that he was supposed to tell Pharaoh about Joseph. And Pharaoh says, "I want to talk to this guy." So he sends messengers to the prison to bring Joseph back. And by this time, Joseph is 30 years old, which means it's been 13 years since he left home, 13 years since he was sold into slavery, 13 years of all of this story and suffering and trial. And he gets cleaned up and he shows up in Pharaoh's court. And what happens next is like the first positive break, the first positive event that happens in Joseph's adult life. It says, Joseph shows up and he immediately explains to Pharaoh. He says, "I don't have the power to interpret dreams." And I'm sure Pharaoh's thinking, "Well, then what are you doing here?" He says, "But God can do this, and God has used me to do this for other people in the past." And so Pharaoh tells Joseph about his dreams. Pharaoh gives him all of the details, and with God's help, Joseph gives an interpretation, an explanation of what the dreams are about. He determined that the dreams were a prediction that there were going to be 7 years of extreme famine in the nation of Egypt after 7 years of great production and prosperity for them. This is the kind of information that 3,600 years ago, this is invaluable for a leader. They don't have meteorologists who are studying, you know, weather patterns and 200 years of weather data to be able to predict patterns. They don't have climatologists that are telling them what to expect and how it's going to affect their agricultural production. And so when Joseph gives Pharaoh a 7-year heads up about a severe famine that's coming, this is a game changer for him. And Joseph recommends to Pharaoh, he says, "This is going to be really bad. In 7 years, it's going to get really bad, and you would be really smart to identify somebody that you could make kind of the famine czar, you know, like put them in charge of prepping the nation for this 7-year stretch of hard times." And Pharaoh looks around at all of these other advisors who, when he gave them the dream information, just kind of went like this. And he says, "Can you guys think of anybody better than this guy right here, this Hebrew guy, to lead us?" And they were all like, "Well, we heard what you did to the cupbearer and the baker, so no, whatever you want to do sounds great to us, you know?" And so in just a flash, I mean, Pharaoh identifies Joseph as the famine czar, gives him more authority, more jurisdiction than anybody else in the kingdom, so that he becomes the second most powerful man in all of Egypt. And you've got to comprehend just the how quick this transition happened. In just the span of a few hours, he goes from being forgotten prisoner to favored prime minister. And he's got new clothes. He's got new jewelry. They give him a woman to get married to. He's got a new wife. And over the next few years, he and his wife have two sons. And he spent the next 7 years successfully preparing Egypt for the upcoming famine. And at this moment in the text, I think it's important and valuable for us to stop and just marvel together at the journey that Joseph has been on up to this point. I mean, you think back to where Joseph has been, to the moments of pain and disappointment and abandonment that he's experienced from the time he was 17. It's been 13 long years, 13 years of suffering, 13 years wondering why this is all happening to me. What have I done? What about this God who promised to do something special with my family? 13 years of having no reason for hope, and then this happens. And in a flash, Pharaoh's messengers show up at the prison. They're looking for Joseph. They take him away to an appointment that's going to change his life forever. He gets power. He gets prestige. He gets influence. He gets luxury that's going to last for the rest of his days. Now, I just wonder, if he had known how it was going to turn out, if he had known that that was going to be the result, would he have been willing to walk the same road to get there? Would he have chosen that? Because I'm not sure he would. Surely, even if he had known how things were going to turn out, he wouldn't have asked for the trouble that he experienced over that time. And maybe you can relate to that. Because maybe as you latch on to God's promises for your life and God's promises for the people that love him, maybe as you look at your own journey and you think to yourself, you know, this has been so hard. There's been moments in my life, events in my life, transitions, relationships in my life that have ended so painfully, or it's all been so difficult for me that I'm not even sure that I would go through that again, even if I knew that things were going to turn out better in the end. It's been so painful. And I want you to notice the names that Joseph chooses for his two sons. He and his wife have two children that are born during that 7 years of prosperity, and Joseph gives Hebrew names to his sons, and the names have significant meaning. The first, it says, Joseph named his older son Manasseh, which means something like cause to forget, cause me to forget. And the reason he gave him that name, he says, because God has made me forget all my troubles and forget everyone in my father's family. God has allowed me to forget all of the crud that's happened to me. And then number two son, Joseph named his second son Ephraim, which means something like fruitful. And he said, God has made me fruitful in this land of my grief. God has made me fruitful despite the fact that I'm in this place that I've never wanted to be. And it's at this point in the story, at this moment in the story, that for the first time, we get a little glimpse into Joseph's inner pain. We get a little window into the heartache that he's gone through. I mean, he's grateful. He's grateful that things are better. He's thankful to God. You know, I'm thankful that God has allowed me to forget. I'm thankful that God has made me fruitful in this place that's been so hard for me. But he's also exposing, he's revealing a bit of his heart and saying, this has been terribly hard for me. This has been a journey that I didn't want to travel. And he's so thankful. He seems so thankful that this part of the story is behind him. And I got to tell you, if the story just ended right there, it would be so satisfactory for us, like so satisfying for all of us, right? Because if the story ended right there, it would just seem like it was just tied up with a neat little bow and things worked out so, so well. We would love to hear a story. We love to watch stories. We love to live out a story where everything just works out perfectly in the end and all the conflict gets resolved and everything's better. I would love to be able to stand up here and tell you that the Bible says if you just wait patiently and if you just be faithful long enough through all of your suffering, one day in this life, God's going to show up and give you power and influence and riches and satisfaction, and maybe you'll be the second or third in command of something big and you'll be a big deal and you'll be able to move past and forget all of the hard things that have happened in your life. I'd love to be able to tell you that that's how it works, that you just hold on long enough and then this life gets really, really, really good at the end. I'd love to be able to tell you that, but one of the things I need you to hear today in the story of Joseph, one of the themes of Joseph's life I need you to remember, is that God was not working things out so that Joseph would get glory in the end. God was working things out for the glory of God. And that's what this story's about. Don't get confused as you read through this saga. Don't get confused in this narrative and think to yourself, well, Joseph's patience worked out. It paid off. He got rewarded for his suffering and his patience and his faithfulness, and God finally made sure that he had the good life that he deserved. Because even though redemption, that story of redemption, is part of Joseph's story, Joseph wasn't getting the results of the life that he had earned. Joseph was taking the next step in the life that God had planned for him. This was Joseph's role in God's story. And the story is so much bigger than Joseph is. This story is not recorded in Genesis so that we'll be impressed with Joseph. This story is not recorded here so that we will, you know, like make an idol to our, you know, like this just impression of Joseph that we can say, we want to be like him. That's not why this story is recorded in this book. This story is recorded so that we will be amazed by God. That's why it's here. The lyrics to one of the songs we just sang, "Into the Word We're Digging Deep." Do you remember what it said? "To know our Father's heart." That's why we're doing this. That's why we're reading this, because the story that God is writing is really big, and we want to learn from these stories what God is up to around us. And so here's what happens. The story doesn't end with Joseph just getting this position of power and all the influence and all the possessions. The final verses of chapter 41 tell us that the famine did indeed show up just the way that Joseph had predicted it would in 7 years. And because of Joseph's leadership, Egypt was prepared for the famine. But all the other nations, all the other people groups around them in that region in the Middle East, not so much. They weren't prepared for this event. And so eventually, as the famine set in and as the crops began to fail and the soil began to dry out, people from other nations, people from other groups started to come to Egypt so that they could buy food. And Joseph, because of his position, he's responsible for this process. He's given people permission to come in and buy grain from all over the place. And then one day, out of nowhere, chapter 42, verse 3 says that Joseph's 10 older brothers made their way down to Egypt so that they could buy grain. Wouldn't you know it? The 10 big brothers who started this whole journey for Joseph, they end up in Joseph's court, in his chambers, asking for permission to buy some of the food that he stored up before the famine. Now, maybe you remember as a kid reading Choose Your Own Adventure books, you know, but I mean, I can only imagine the decision that I would make in Joseph's position about how this is going to go when my brothers show up, right? Like, I have an idea of what's going to come naturally to me, the kind of action that I might take. And what's interesting is Joseph's brothers don't recognize him. They show up, and enough time has passed. It's been almost a decade and a half since they saw him last, and he's got all of this new stuff. He's got a new look. He's got a new language. He's speaking to them through an interpreter, and they don't recognize their brother, and they certainly didn't expect him in this context. I mean, never could have imagined that this would be the person that they'd be talking to. And the text says that they came in, and they, as they would for any Egyptian official, they bowed down with their faces to the ground in front of him, which reminds us of the dream that Joseph had had when he was still a teenager, this dream about his family eventually bowing down to him. And over the course of the next few chapters of Genesis, we see this drama play out between Joseph and his brothers. We don't have time to read the whole thing together. You can find it in chapters 42 through 50 of Genesis. But what happens is Joseph keeps his brothers in the dark about his identity for a while. speaks to them with an interpreter, even though he can understand everything that they're saying. He demands information about their family back home. He says, where do you come from? Who are your people? Who still lives at the home where you're trying to take all of this grain to? And all the time on the inside, what he's really asking is, how's my dad? How's my sister? How's my baby brother? How's my stepmom doing? He's asking these kind of questions, but he's in this position where he's doing it all through the interpreter and being kind of demanding with them. Eventually, he accuses them of being spies, and he works this out. He demands that the only way he's going to allow them all to go back home to Canaan is if he keeps one of them as a prisoner while the others go home and bring him his baby brother. Go home and bring me your brother so that I can meet him and I'll believe that you've been honest with me about who you are. And it's so interesting because as he's standing there, Joseph is listening to his brothers speaking in their native language and they don't think he can understand, but they're riddled with anxiety about how this is going. Is our brother going to be stuck here forever? Is dad going to let us bring Benjamin with us? And they're worried about it. And in their conversation, they talk to each other about how this must be punishment for what they did 13 years ago. And Joseph's listening to the whole thing. Chapter 42, verse 21. Speaking among themselves, they said, clearly we are being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw the anguish on his face when he was pleading for his life, and we didn't listen, and that's why we're in this trouble. That's why we're having this problem. It's got to be. And so we find out that for the last 13 years, these guys haven't forgotten. They've been carrying with them the guilt. They've been carrying with them the shame of the secret that they kept from their family and all of the cover-up that they did and the fact that they just pretended as if he never existed. And over the course of the next couple of chapters, the brothers travel home. They eventually return back with their baby brother Benjamin. And every time the brothers and Joseph are in the same room, Joseph finds himself having to excuse himself and go to another room where he can cry and be alone for a moment and then collect himself. Because it's just so emotional to see this and to be back together in the same room. But eventually, Joseph arranges for all 12 of them to be in one room with it, together, and he reveals his identity to them. And it goes like this. I am Joseph. This is chapter 45, verse 4. He tells his brothers, he says, I'm Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery, as if they were going to be confused about which Joseph he was referring to, you know, like, oh, that Joseph, you know. And I wonder if their jaws hit the floor at that moment. I wonder, you know, as their hearts sink or come up into their throat or something, I wonder if they just immediately burst into tears, and not tears of happiness, but tears of terror, because they know this could go really, really bad. But verse 5, Joseph tells his brothers, he says, don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. That's not the choose your own adventure story that I was going to choose for this. But he goes on, verse 6. He says, this famine that's ravaged the land for 2 years, it's going to last for 5 more years. And there's not going to be any agricultural production, no plowing, no harvesting. He says, God has sent me ahead of you. He's put me in this outpost ahead of time to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. And so he says, so it was God. God had a hand in this. It was God who sent me here, not you. And he's the one who made me an advisor to Pharaoh. He's the one who made me the manager of this entire palace and the governor of all Egypt. And then he tells him his whole story. He tells him the story of what's happened over the last 13 years. He tells him about what it was like to be in that caravan of slaves heading to Egypt. He tells him about what it was like to be on the block, to be sold as a slave and to be purchased by Potiphar and to be falsely accused and thrown to prison. He tells him all of the story. But the one thing he doesn't do is he doesn't do what would come naturally to me. He doesn't use this moment when he has all the power and when he has all the leverage to get back at his brothers. Because Joseph realized, and we hear it in his language here, Joseph realized that the story that they were living was part of something bigger than any of them. He realized that God was up to something and that God was using them with all of their mistakes, all of their sins, all of their baggage, all of the history, all the bad blood between them. God was using this whole group, all 12 of these brothers, to save their family from starvation. And suddenly, this promise that they had grown up hearing, these covenantal promises from God that they had listened to from their father and their grandfather and who had heard them from his father before him, these promises that said, I'm going to make you into a great nation and I'm going to bless the entire world through you. And Joseph must have at some point felt like that was hopeless. And as Joseph's brothers were starving in Canaan, they must have wondered what's going to happen to the promise. And Joseph says, this is happening on purpose. God's saving us. And Joseph showed love to his brothers, and he showed mercy to his brothers, and he forgave his brothers for what they had done in the past, and he invited them to go home and bring their father Jacob back. And when they did, Jacob and his entire family, all the kids, all the grandkids, all of the servants, everybody else came to live in Egypt, and Joseph made sure that they had land, and they had food, and they had resources, and they had a place where their family could survive during the remaining years of that famine. And all because Joseph took his pain and he looked beyond that. He looked beyond his experience and he was able to see how God was at work in his life to bless the lives of others. And he was able to treat people different because he was aware of what God was doing in him. He was aware of what God was doing through him. He was able to respond with grace to other people who had hurt him. Even people who had hurt him on purpose, he was able to respond with grace because he was paying attention. He was in tune to how God was using his present circumstances, his hurt, and his history to be a blessing to somebody else. Now, as we've worked our way through the story of Joseph, we've heard very little from Joseph directly about what he thought of all of this. I mean, we've read some of the conversations that Joseph's been a part of. We've heard from the narrator of the story who's recording this stuff about what was going on with Joseph. But Joseph wasn't like keeping a journal. He's not writing down his thoughts about everything that happened to him while he was at Potiphar's house or while he was in the prison or while he was in the cistern or any of those places in between. We don't know about the state of his heart when he's traveling with that caravan of slave traders as a 17-year-old kid. We don't know what it felt like when he was purchased by Potiphar to come work in that house. We don't know how Joseph responded internally when he was thrown into prison without a trial and without a prayer. We just don't know. We don't know the ins and outs of Joseph's spiritual struggle. We don't know what his journey felt like. We don't know the ups and downs of the lifetime that he was navigating faith and trying to remember that God's always said he cared about him. We don't know if there were days when Joseph thought about ending it all. We don't know. We don't know if there were days when he wanted to curse God or days when he did. We don't know if there were times when he cried out to what must have felt like empty air, begging for relief. We just don't know. But what we do know is how Joseph's story ended up. And I'm not just talking about the physical circumstances. I'm not talking about the possessions and the prestige and the power and the position. I'm not talking about all the luxuries that he enjoyed. What we do know is where Joseph's heart ended up at the end of this journey. And at the end of Joseph's brief little moment in history, at the end of his life, he looked back on everything that he'd been through and he understood what the narrator of the story's been trying to tell us all along, that God was with Joseph, that God was with him. And I wonder what it would be like if you and I could have that kind of perspective where we step back and we look at our life as a whole and we imagine, we envision, we believe and trust that God might be up to something. I wonder what it would be like if we allowed ourselves to have that kind of perspective, to believe that even the hardships in our life might be leading to something that would bring glory to God. There's a moment in the New Testament, one of the followers of Jesus, a guy named Paul, he himself had been through lots of trial, lots of struggle, lots of persecution. And he wrote and described God this way. He said, God is our merciful Father, and he's the source of all of our comfort, even in the hard stuff. He comforts us in all of our troubles so that, and he doesn't say so we'll feel better, so that we can comfort others, he says. When other people are troubled, we will be able to give them the same comfort that God has given to us. And if you look real close, that's the Joseph story. That's the story of a guy who went through all kinds of difficulties of his own, but because God was with him and because God used him, he became a blessing for a bunch of other people. If you look even closer, that's the Jesus story too. If you look real close, you'll start to recognize the character of Jesus. You remember how he was treated, right? You remember the trials that he went through. You remember the way that he was questioned and challenged, and nobody really could say anything bad about him at all, and so they had to make stuff up, and they had to bring in false witnesses and people to say things about him that weren't true. You remember how he was arrested at knife point and how people just ran and fled and left him alone and how he went with them even though he could have stopped it. You remember how he was put on trial and it was just a sham of a trial, just a joke, because the verdict had been decided before it ever started. And so it didn't make any difference that he hadn't done anything wrong. You remember that. And you remember how the Roman ruler who had an opportunity to stop it, said, I don't find anything wrong with this guy. And all of the people said, never mind, we don't care. Give us back this guy from prison that tried to kill people and take this man and kill him. You remember that? About how they stripped him and they beat him and they spit on him and they made him carry his cross up a hill and then they nailed him to it, and as if that wasn't enough, they left him intentionally alive, hanging on the cross for quite a while, for hours at a time, and they sat there and they ridiculed him and called him names and they spit on him and they gambled for his clothes right there in front of him, and they watched him bleed and they watched him suffer and they watched him struggle and they watched him die. And then 3 days later, you know what he did? He came back from the dead. That's the incredible part. But maybe an equally incredible part is he came back and he talked to all of the people who had abandoned him, and he said, you know what? I forgive you. Because God was using every bit of that to save the world. This is the Joseph story. This is the Jesus story. And I believe if we step back and gain the right perspective, this is the part of the story God's writing through you to. Is that your suffering and your struggle and your disappointment and your hurt and your baggage and your mistakes and the bad blood and the relationships that haven't gone well, every bit of that is meant to be something that God is going to use to bring glory to himself if you continue to trust him. This is what your story is going to be about if you trust that God is with you. And that's why it's recorded in here for us. Not so we'd be so impressed with Joseph, but so we'd get an idea of what God's up to. What he was up to 3,600 years ago, what he was up to 2,000 years ago, and what he's up to in 2018. He's blessing the world by providing comfort to those of us who trust him.